Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And Mamma Mia, that is some Super Tuesday.
Super Trooper, lights are gonna find me, but I won't feel blue like I always do. 'Cause somewhere in the crowd, there's you.
Somewhere in the crowd of candidates, a pair of frontrunners could emerge to put an end to the ill-mannered circus this campaign has been up until now. In a dozen states and one territory, polls open today in primaries and caucuses. Texas is certainly the biggest prize for both parties, with 155 delegates up for grabs on the Republican side and 251 delegates for Democrats. Ted Cruz has staked a lot on winning his home state, but the latest polls show Donald Trump narrowing what was a solid double-digit lead in Texas for Cruz. A lukewarm squeaker or even a narrow win for Trump could knock Ted Cruz out of the race. Senator Marco Rubio still needs to come in first somewhere in Super Tuesday voting, as does Governor John Kasich, to show some kind of regional strength. Stella Chavez is a reporter for KERA in Dallas, speaking with Texans at polling places about who they're voting for and about the issues that motivated them to come out and cast a ballot on this Super Tuesday.
I've been standing outside a Collin County poll in North Texas. Collin County is a heavily Republican area north of Dallas, about 30 minutes. I'm in Plano, Texas, home of Toyota, which recently moved here from California. And it's also a diverse county. There is a large Asian population here and a growing population. And I just spoke to some voters who, surprisingly, a couple of Democratic voters, people who voted for Bernie and people who voted for Hillary.
My name is Janet Chapman. I live in Plano, Texas, and actually I'm retired Air Force. I voted for Hillary Clinton because I belong to the Democratic Party, and I don't know anything or much about Sanders. I voted for Bill Clinton. So knowing that he's backing her makes her a better candidate.
My name is David Oldfather, and I live in Plano, Texas, and I'm a network architect. I voted for Bernie Sanders because I believe he's the only sane candidate that's out there and the most respectable and straightforward guy that I could actually stand behind. I think many of the other candidates leave a lot to be desired.
There's a lot at stake in Texas. 222 delegates on the Democratic side, and 155 delegates on the Republican side. I spoke to a couple of voters who voted for Ted Cruz and who say that they feel he does have a chance.
My name is Dustin Smith. I'm from Plano, Texas. I'm a sales manager. I voted for Ted Cruz because he's a constitutionalist. I think we've really gotten too far away from our founding.
My name is Jeff Chapman. I live in Plano, and I am a retired military colonel, and I work at Immigration. I voted for Trump, and I think the issues are, for me, more or less political correctness than immigration. I think we've gone too much in what we can say and what we can't say.
Here in Texas, Hillary Clinton is leading in the polls against Bernie Sanders, and Ted Cruz is ahead of Trump. People are saying that they are really impressed with the turnout of people. One gentleman said a lot of people were here for early voting. We've heard that early voting here in Collin County has been the highest it's been in a long time. And they're expecting a high turnout today. It's supposed to be a really nice day. It will be windy, but so far so good.
Stella Chavez is a reporter for KERA in Dallas. Minnesota, according to the polls, is the closest thing to Bernie Sanders territory on this Super Tuesday. It is the only Midwestern state on the calendar today. It's a caucus, which means no action until later this evening. And Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders is hoping to do well in the state of the late progressive Senator Paul Wellstone, where 38 Democratic delegates are up for grabs. Michael Mulcahy, political editor for Minnesota Public Radio, has more.
Bernie Sanders has been spending a lot of time in Minnesota over the past few days. Yesterday, he held a rally in Minneapolis where he said Minnesota is key to his plans.
We can win, no question, here in Minnesota if we have a turnout.
Sanders has also been running TV ads for weeks at a cost of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Hillary Clinton has matched him on ads, but she has spent much less time here in Minnesota. TV ads might not make much of a difference anyway in a caucus state where organization is usually more important for a campaign to get its supporters out. While Sanders appears to have an advantage in generating energy among his supporters, Clinton has an edge with endorsements. She has the support of Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton, Senators Amy Klobuchar and Al Franken, and a host of other elected Democratic officials. The Republican candidates have paid less attention to the state and are not running TV ads. Ted Cruz got an early start on organizing in Minnesota, but Marco Rubio has clearly targeted the state in recent days. Rubio held a rally here last week and is due back today. He has also picked up a number of endorsements from prominent Republicans, including former Governor Tim Pawlenty and former Senator Norm Coleman. A big question mark on the Republican side is Donald Trump. There's been little sign of any organizing by his campaign, but it seems unlikely the surge of support he's seen elsewhere would not hit Minnesota. Caucuses are generally light turnout affairs, and they are notoriously difficult to poll. 8 years ago, turnout set a record, but it was still less than 10% of eligible voters. A strong turnout tonight could be good news for Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. This is Mike Mulcahy, political editor for Minnesota Public Radio, filing for The Takeaway.
We now go to the increasingly purple state of Virginia. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump both held rallies there last night. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, is outside a polling place in Culpeper, Virginia, a 90-minute drive southwest of Washington, D.C.
You know, America never stopped being great. We've got to make America whole. We have to work with everybody, bring people together, quit being divided. I really regret the language that is being used by Republicans. Scapegoating people, finger pointing, blaming.
That's Hillary Clinton last night campaigning here in Virginia. Right now, I'm standing outside of Fauquier High School in Warrenton, Virginia. This is Fauquier County. This is a county that Hillary Clinton won in 2008 when she was up in the primary against Barack Obama. There are some Democratic voters in Fauquier County. It's majority Republican. But the Democrats that I encountered coming out of the polling place this morning, three or four or even five of them, all said that they were supporting, at least in the primary, Bernie Sanders. They're people like Susanna Vega. She's 35, and she's a nurse midwife.
I believe he cares about the middle class and the poor. And I feel that stands out the most amongst the Democratic candidates. I believe in his passion. I believe in his commitment to the common people.
Now, Susanna Vega said that if Hillary Clinton wins in the primary, that she'd be willing to support her in the general election. Now, Virginia, of course, is a swing state, a purple state, so it's not just about the Democrats here. Here's Donald Trump campaigning yesterday here in Virginia.
It's going to be a very important day because what's going to happen is you're going to look back on this day in 2 years from now, in 4 years from now, and you are going to say that you were there at the beginning. We're going to have a renaissance in this country. We're going to have a renaissance.
Now, Donald Trump seems on track to replicate his national lead, his dominance so far. He's polling about 15 points ahead of Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz here in Virginia, and that's going to be key. Republican voters here in Fauquier County are conservative. I encountered several of them, some for Marco Rubio, some for Ted Cruz, and a lot of them who said that if it comes down to the general, they don't know if they could support Trump.
My name is Krista Stromberg. I live up in Marshall. I vote for Ted Cruz. I think we need somebody who's stable and honest and principled, following the Constitution.
You're pretty conservative, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to weave the scenario that you know might be coming, which is Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton.
Yes, I realize that. And then you got two devils up there.
This is the key swing state. Look for big victories, according to the polling anyway, by Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump tonight in Virginia. Conservatives dominate the West in the southern portions of this state, African Americans in the southeast part of the state, and Democrats in northern Virginia outside of Washington, D.C. It's a battleground. Virginia is purple, one of the few remaining truly purple states left in the country. It's a fight today, but in November, these candidates are going to be on the ground a lot more. Here.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. So while people are voting, maybe it's tasteless to campaign, but it's certainly fabulous to speculate about what's going to happen. We want you to dream your headline. What are you hoping to read tomorrow? What are you terrified of seeing? San Antonio, Texas, dream Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump. Nightmare, Hillary Clinton versus Ted Cruz.
This is Jennifer in Portland, Oregon, and my dream headline for Super Tuesday is Christian sweep Sanders to victory.
My name is Tom. I'm from Little Canada, Minnesota, and my nightmare headline would be Hillary wins. Yay. I just don't agree with any of her policies or anything she's ever done. I just don't feel like she's ever telling the truth.
My name is Megan. I'm calling from Marysville, Washington, and my dream headline is Trump has change of heart, moves to Yemen.
Welcome to my nightmare.
This is Nathan from Austin, Texas. My nightmare headline would be Donald Trump wins the Republican and Democratic nominations, vows to deport dissenters.
I'm right.
My goodness, Spokane, Washington dream. Bill Clinton starts picking out drapery colors for White House.
This is Jeremy from Dallas, Texas. And for me, a nightmare headline after Super Tuesday voting would be Trump takes the cake.
This is Jane Moorhead from Dublin, California. My dream headline for tomorrow would be Trump trounced, Kasich soars. Clinton has comfortable lead over Sanders. Cruz struggles while Rubio maintains a comfortable second.
This is Angela Sample from Clinton, Arkansas, and my nightmare is Trump winning the Republican nomination.
Cheer up, sleepy Gene. Oh, what can it mean to a daydream believer and a homecoming queen?
Hi, this is Judy from Cambridge, Mass., working for Hillary. My headline would be, feel the turn. It's our turn. Hillary Clinton, the next president of the United States.
Now, Judy, that's not a headline. We would call that more like a bumper sticker. But since you're working for Hillary, that makes perfect sense. Share your dreams and your nightmares for Super Tuesday. 8778-MY-TAKE is the number. Leave us a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. And later this hour, tech dreams and busts. One author worries that the growth at all costs model in America is ruining the economy.
If we look at a company like Google, which we thought was on our team, you know, that this was going to be the way that the economy got restored and we were all going to be able to create value and have new kinds of jobs. And the digital economy didn't work out the way we thought it would, that these companies are getting bigger while the rest of us are getting poorer.
Growth versus economic security. Douglas Rushkoff talks about that later this hour. This is The Takeaway.
And from Staples, offering tech services for small business owners like PC setup and repair. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples. Make more happen. The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Every 4 years, it seems, a group of sinners from a much complained about Gomorrah-like city, Washington, D.C., finds their faith, sees the light, experiences a revelation. This finding religion born again and again experience for these folks just happens to coincide with the presidential election campaign. Have you noticed?
Any president who doesn't begin every day on his knees
isn't fit to be commander-in-chief of this country.
Amen.
And what I believe in and what my spirituality is about is that we're all in this together.
The next step is to argue that the teachings of mainstream Christianity is hate speech. That's a real and present danger.
What's better than raising your voices to God and being able to connect that brings others along with you?
That's my second favorite book of all time. Do you know what my first is? The Bible.
Amen. Take me to church.
Nothing beats the Bible, according to Donald Trump. According to the Pew Research Center, nearly half of all people in the 12 Super Tuesday states who identify as or lean toward the Republican Party are evangelical Protestants. And there are plenty of evangelicals who identify as Democrats as well. Are evangelical Christians hearing this message from the candidates? Will they turn out today? Gabe Lyons is co-author of Good Faith. The book is out today. The founder of Q, a Christian learning community. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks, John. Good to be with you.
Now, does that language from candidates, and we included some Democrats in there as well, does that feel patronizing to you as a Christian, or does it feel sincere? How do you respond to this ritual every 4 years?
I think a little bit of both. Year after year, when you see in elections how much that pandering can take place towards Christians and to evangelicals, you get kind of used to it. There's also a part of me, though, that does recognize the sincerity of this for many of these leaders. You know, you and I maybe aren't often asked to talk on a public stage and share deeply and intimately about our faith. And so I think for many of these candidates, it's probably awkward to get out there and try to express what they really believe about God. And yet they try to do it because I think they understand how important it is in American life, especially in the South, to talk about their heritage, talk about what they believe.
Before we talk about the candidates, let's talk about the Reagan experience when evangelicals really voted with Ronald Reagan and felt, I think, at the end of those two terms that not much had been accomplished and that the social agenda of evangelicals was really ignored by the conservative Republicans. Do you worry about that happening again? And what candidate most worries you in that regard?
Well, there's a healthy skepticism, I think, these days for Christians to ever assume that a candidate is going to go in there and make all these changes that just completely line up with a Judeo-Christian vision for the country. The Reagan experience certainly also sent a new generation. I mean, I was 10 years old in the middle of that administration, and it made me, just growing up, not put so much weight on a presidential candidate to truly represent what faithfulness looks like in the culture. And I think when we do that and we heap too much into this idea that politics in general is going to shape the imagination of the American people, we've made a big mistake. And so the religious right, I think, did that. And now the pendulum has swung the other way. And I think a new generation of people are saying, you know, we're just not going to fall for that.
Is there a temptation to back a winner in the case of front runner Donald Trump? Or are you looking for someone who has true religion here?
I do think for a lot of Christians and those that I interact with a lot, no, they're taking a very hard look at whether this person has integrity and character. And someone like Trump, of course, raises all those flags of saying, hey, is this really someone, even if he can speak some of the language, even if he pronounces 2 Corinthians wrong, is this someone we could really count on and get behind? Should we as Christians really support somebody who sort of leads with pride, is quite arrogant, is somebody who puts down many of those who are marginalized? I don't think many of the Christians I interact with are saying this is somebody we should get behind. And so I think you find with amongst any people group, but the evangelical specifically, a lot of splintering, a lot of disagreement.
Hillary's seemingly sincere and consistent church going in her life, does that impress evangelicals at all, Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, no, I don't think so, because evangelicals have a high value on the pursuit of being pro-life, and that's something Hillary's never been for, and her support of Planned Parenthood, gay marriage, so many of the things that are out of step with the majority of what evangelicals think about, no matter how much she might describe prayer and how much she might describe going to church here and there, I think people see through that, and they care about a faith that's a good faith.
Do you think the death of Justice Scalia means that this election is more likely to be about abortion and the future of Roe v. Wade than you had expected going into this campaign?
I'm not sure it will. I think the death of Justice Scalia certainly has just raised everybody's attention to these big ideas over decades and how they start to shape policy. We can see how the Roe v. Wade decision over 40 years ago has affected the way we live life, how our imagination thinks. But on the pro-life front, I mean, honestly, that's shifted so much. We're really winning on that front. There's so many more mothers who now are able to see their child in their womb through ultrasounds and are turning away from abortion and moving towards giving birth, either through adoption that's provided through churches who are advocating for foster care and adoption and doing a lot more to be pro-life after a person's born.
Although the numbers, the majority numbers are with pro-choice.
Yeah, no, it's shifting though. If you look community by community, you look at certain states like North Carolina, for example, they've seen a drastic drop in the number of abortions. You can see in the younger generation, they're more pro-life than their parents were. I think this is due to science. I think it's due to people hearing about the negative experiences many women have had once they've had a post-abortion experience.
Are you behind a particular candidate?
No.
And will you make up your mind, or have you just decided to be out of it for a while?
No. I'll make up my mind. I think right now part of what I'm trying to do is help a lot of evangelicals kind of understand the landscape, understand that we're not just one segment, and to think about how does your beliefs start to play themselves out in a candidate. And by the way, reminding them, don't put too much weight or stock in a presidential candidate and thinking they're going to actually make the kind of changes you want to see in the world.
Gabe Lyons is co-author of Good Faith, which is a book out today. He's the founder of Q, a learning community that mobilizes Christians to think well and advance good in society. Gabe, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We wanted to know from you what your ideal result or dreaded outcome for Super Tuesday will be. Rapid City, South Dakota said, Bernie Sanders wins it all. Look out, America, change is on the way. Russellville, Arkansas says, dream come true, Rand and Ron Paul come back and sweep the nominations with a grassroots write-in vote.
Aloha, this is Michelle calling from Honolulu, and here's my dream headline for Super Tuesday. Bernie wins big, announces Hillary as running mate. Cooler heads prevail in the GOP. Rubio wins. Trump takes his hair and goes home.
Tell us your predictions. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave us a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, offering tech services for small business owners like PC setup and repair. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples. Make more happen.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is what change sounds like in Tehran.
We trusted the rightists, and the result was not so positive. I don't want to talk about what happened in the country, but there were lots of embezzlements and so on. So I felt another group should come in and take over, and new things needed to happen.
One very optimistic Tehran voter there, speaking to the Associated Press about last week's Iranian parliamentary elections, the results of which are still being tallied. In Tehran, though, allies of reformist President Hassan Rouhani came out ahead, winning at least 85 seats in parliament. Voters ousted the two most conservative clerics from the Assembly of Experts, the panel that picks the country's supreme leaders. Thomas Erdbrink joins us from the Tehran Bureau of our partner, The New York Times, where he is bureau chief. Thomas, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
Are we seeing signs in these results, and it's preliminary and it's so hard to read, of a passing of the torch of who is the supreme leader, who is the voice of the supreme leader, what tone the supreme leader will embody in the future? Because, these are the waning years of Ayatollah Khamenei.
Let's just pedal back for a second and look at what happened. There were two elections in Iran, a parliamentary vote, a regular vote for the parliament, and an election to this assembly of experts, the council that you just referred to, that has the power to supervise the supreme leader and, in case of his passing, to elect a new one. Now, it is kind of hard to measure where the supreme leader stands in all of this, but when you look at the results of at least the parliamentary elections, there is a growing sense that Iran is sort of moving towards the political middle. And that is, of course, something that could never happen without his blessing. Now, what are the signs for this? There is, of course, the nuclear deal that everybody has heard about that has led to the lifting of sanctions. Then we have seen the outreach, even by Supreme Leader Khamenei himself, to European countries asking them to invest in Iran, so sort of opening up Iran's economy. Now we are seeing these parliamentary elections where we don't know the results of just yet, but where we can see that the group that supports the government, a group of reformists and moderates, have completely won all 30 seats for the capital, for the parliament. Now, there's 290 seats in total in Iran. We don't know yet how the division of these seats is in the rest of the country. But what seems to be sure is that the government of President Rouhani has at least one a strong minority in parliament, which will help him, A, to pass economic reforms and other things, but B, is again a sign that the supreme leader at least doesn't oppose this sort of move to the middle.
Would you say the sentiments of that voter that we played earlier is a widespread one, that we trusted the right wing, the results not positive, there was corruption, we want to move forward, I'm optimistic? Is that a feeling that's common?
I think if we look at the biggest group here in Iran, which in my view are the urban middle classes, who together make up 40 million people in this country of 80 million. Now, those people a very long time ago already started feeling very uncomfortable with the rightists or the hardliners. Those people actually have been, whenever they could, been voting for change. We saw that in 2009 when the hardliners won the presidential elections, but millions of middle-class Iranians took to the streets in protest. Then we saw it again in 2013, when they again came out to vote and voted for President Hassan Rouhani, this moderate cleric that executed the nuclear deal with the blessing of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And then we saw it now in these parliamentary elections.
Thomas Erdbrink, Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.
A brutal crime in an environment of fear. Last week, police in Fort Wayne, Indiana, found three young men shot dead in a home. The young men were all Black from immigrant families, and two of them were Muslim. Police say they are not investigating the execution-style murders as a hate crime, but have released few other details about the case. A hashtag on Twitter, Our Three Boys, has started, with Muslims from across the country calling for a full investigation. Gohar Salam is a surgeon and the president of the Universal Education Foundation, an Islamic school in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Salam says this crime has turned up the heat in his community, already fearful from some of the overt anti-Muslim rhetoric coming from the presidential campaign.
The initial reaction for this crime was that, as we are concerned and worried about, that there are now people beginning to take their hate out against the Muslims. But that is not actually what this crime is about. We know we don't have all the information at this time, but I have cautioned people to rush to any judgments. There is an inquiry going on into these three murders. And so far, we don't have any evidence to say that this was truly a hate crime. So in the beginning, when something like this happens and the news break, there was almost a hysteria which was beginning to develop among the Muslims. I have full faith in the justice system, and I'm hoping that the police and the authorities would be able to apprehend whoever committed this and hopefully bring them to justice.
Dr. Gohar Salam, can you tell me if anything has changed in the way you practice your religion since, say, 9/11, in just this environment of fear that you've talked about? Do you do anything differently, wear anything differently? Do you protect yourself in some way?
I do not so much, but I will tell you that I have worried about my safety to the point where I did take some self-defense courses myself. Unfortunately, I know that there are some people, particularly some women, young women, who have had to make some very major modifications based on what is happening. And I would give you just a simple example of wearing a hijab. You know, unfortunately, when a non-Muslim person sees a young woman wearing a hijab, sometimes it is looked at as a sign of oppression. And the sad part is that even in Christianity, you look at the kind faces of the sisters and the nuns, their heads are covered with scarves as well. So scarf is not something, when you take it on your head, is not a sign of an oppression, but it is just a sign where the person is asking for some respect. So these young girls, and some of them are going to colleges and universities, so they are not being forced to wear that, but they are doing that by their own choice. But unfortunately, I know quite a few of them who have had to make the choice of not wearing that, so this way they are not so visible outside. So there have been, unfortunately, incidences of hate against the Muslims where these women have been followed and they are really concerned. So unfortunately, the way the Muslims are beginning to think of living life here is beginning to change. I would just like to hope that that change can be a positive one. One of the things that I have talked about for a long time among my friends and in the community is that as Muslims, we have truly not done our part living life civically and in the society that we live in. You know, as a Muslim, yes, we follow our faith, we offer the prayers, we go to work, we take care of our families, and mostly that is where we have kept our lives to. And life is way more than that. This is a place where you really want to be civically involved and you really want to go out. And one of the reasons why these backlashes are against Islam is because people do not know about Islam. I'm just hoping that there would be a positive change among Muslims, when you see warning signs like this, that this is the time where we need to open the doors for our mosques so people can walk in and hear the sermons. And all this propaganda which is happening, that mosques would spread, God forbid, a message of hate or violence, you can listen to yourselves. And then you can make a decision what Islam truly is about, rather than just a hearsay and following some of these leaders' statements.
Dr. Salam, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, John.
Gohar Salam is a surgeon and the president of the Universal Education Foundation, an Islamic school in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Great Big Amazon, the company, not the river, seems to have outgrown its relationship with the Postal Service, FedEx, and UPS. Impatient over service lapses, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, who has his own rocket business, you know, may be interested in amassing his own fleet of planes, trains, trucks, and drones to deliver goods. That would make Amazon a full-blown global logistics company. Internal Amazon documents reveal a plan for a global delivery network that would control the flow of goods from China to the U.S. John Wells is a former CFO for PepsiCo and Frito-Lay, who is currently professor of management practice at the Harvard Business School. He says for an online retailer, efficient logistics are critical, and the U.S. is actually way behind its competitors.
Customers want speed, and they want it for nothing. And so Amazon is spending a lot of time looking around the world at how it can actually improve its performance. Many say that they're looking into competing in China. I doubt that they will do particularly well there, because there's some very sophisticated competitors in China. JD.com is the lead player in Amazon's space. It is the Amazon of China. They deliver 85% of their product either the same day or the following day, way ahead of what happens in the United States. But Alibaba is the granddad, the absolute granddad of online in China. They're a marketplace. Amazon is also a marketplace, but they've got five times the size of Amazon and also delivering a lot the same day, the following day, and they're going down to doing it within 2 hours. In the United States, expensive, slow logistics is holding back the development of online retail.
So China makes this an absolute imperative for Amazon. It's not simply being annoyed at the U.S. Postal Service or UPS or FedEx.
What's actually happening in this space, to be competitive, you have to offer very fast delivery and typically free. It's amazing what happens when you take the delivery charges away and sales boom. But in order to do that, in order to offer very low-cost delivery, you need to keep your inventory near the customer. And so what's happening is people are distributing their product ever closer to the customer. Alibaba is just buying, at the moment, the number one consumer electronics retail bricks-and-mortar store, and in order that they can put product there and deliver it within 2 hours to the consumer. That's the equivalent, by the way, of Amazon buying Best Buy in order to get closer to the consumer. Now, the only problem is How do you get it from the local stores to the consumer's front door, the last mile? And this is the big challenge. Ideally, you get them to pick it up. And up to half of customers like to come and pick it up. But the other half, how do you get it to them and how do you get it to them quickly? Well, Amazon is figuring out a very cost-effective way. They're creating the equivalent of Uber. They're testing it. It's Uber, Amazon Now, Amazon Next. They're actually getting drivers with their own cars to deliver the parcels very, very cost-effectively. Question, you know, can UPS do this? The United States Parcel Service do this? Two-hour delivery using non-union labor? I very much doubt it. But Amazon must forge the way if it really wants to offer and be competitive and really drive more online retailing in the United States.
Are UPS warehouses and FedEx warehouses, are they duplicates, essentially, of what Amazon already has?
No, not really, basically. But from Amazon's point of view, what they need to do is to put these locations, these distribution locations, with the exact inventory they require close to the consumers. We all already have an infrastructure like that in the United States. It's called big box stores. You know, you take a Best Buy, they're probably within 20 minutes of 80 or 90% of the U.S. population. The only issue is at the moment they consider themselves to be bricks and mortar retailers as opposed to distribution centers and showrooms and places for people to come and return their products.
So when are we going to see this? In other words, how soon will Amazon make its footprint known on streets and in, sort of delivery fleets?
It's happening now, essentially. I think their test that Amazon Now is in more than 20 cities in the world. Amazon Next is being tested in 4 or 5 in the United States at the moment. If these prove cost effective, we'll see them roll out very, very aggressively. Specialized warehouses and the capability of integrating all of this into one much more effective logistics operation, that is Amazon's business. They've been in it right from the very start. They've been in it 20 years and they're getting better and better at it.
Can you be profitable in the last mile distribution game if you don't deliver other people's stuff, particularly if one of the features of your product is that you give your delivery service for free?
You have to remember there are some consumers that once they've decided to buy something, I'd call them the now generation, they want it now. Others are prepared to wait a couple of days and they can probably get a more cost-effective service through the United States Postal Service. Now, there's literally hundreds of thousands of people that are prepared to sign up for this. I could almost imagine, being controversial, that the employees of the United States Parcel Service during their day shift will be delivering parcels on a regular basis and then they'll be doing a second shift on their own account because they know where the addresses are and can do it faster than other players. The issue is if you provide a lot of the volume to any player out there, then you effectively control them and you can get excellent service.
And the drivers and employees for Amazon, are they going to be different from the Amazon employees that work in the warehouse? Will they be eligible for benefits? Will they be employees and be able to rely on them?
If they basically grow out the Uber model, it will be very close to the Uber model, where people basically move in and out of the market using their own resources in order to basically deliver the parcels. And so it is not an easy task. Regulation will move in, and we will see at the end of the day which way regulation goes. When your parcel is delivered, you can pass back feedback, identify it. When it was delivered, there's an enormous number of controls over poor service, over individuals that are providing it. And as soon as, if they do not perform to the right level, then they lose the opportunity to provide the service. This is how Uber works. This is how it would work in a new world with last mile delivery, Uber-esque, a la Amazon.
John Wells, professor of management practice at Harvard Business School and chair of the Senior Retail Forum at Harvard. Thank you so much, professor.
You're most welcome.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Businesses love to talk about their sustained growth. In fact, Amazon, as a case in point, gets in trouble with its shareholders all the time for building market share by growing rather than by building a gigantic cash reserve like Apple has, for instance. It turns out that sustained growth may be an oxymoron, though. Douglas Rushkoff writes in his new book that what is truly sustainable may be non-growth. The new book is throwing rocks at the Google bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. He says while the growth at all costs mentality has long been a problem, It's only gotten worse over time, posing major problems for today's tech CEOs, their employees, and the global economy as a whole.
As I did my research, I found it's really, for the past 75 years, corporate profits over their net worth has been going down. It's not really just an internet story, but the end of a cycle, the end of a certain kind of industrial business that just keeps growing and growing. I mean, they're still good at growing. They're just bad at deploying the capital they've accumulated. You know, so they're like these obese institutions that are storing cash in their fat, but they can't actually create any muscle or any economic activity.
There's two ways of looking at this. One is the sort of short-term view last 100 years, which I consider sort of the short-term yeah. view here. And that's very interesting. But let's just put that on hold for a second, because there are societies in the history of civilization that came to a kind of no-growth, sustainability equilibrium in the way that they interact with their resources around them. Do you think the way this works is that there's some like giant explosion crash and then sustainability is our lesson that we learn, or do you evolve to that point of sustainability?
Well, whichever one happens, whether it's an apocalyptic explosion or a smooth transition, our strategy has to be the same. In other words, what we do is we need to build local, resilient, sustainable businesses. We need to start optimizing for the circulation and for transaction, not for the extraction of capital from communities. You know, we have to start looking at how can workers be part owners in the companies that they work in rather than just employees, so that we start really not redistributing the wealth that we've already earned, but kind of pre-distributing the means of production so that everyone can participate in value creation. I don't know which way it's going to go. It's you know, it's hard to tell, but I'm hoping that certainly now, as enough people look at the headlines, when people see that, oh, look, Twitter's making $500 million a quarter, but it's considered a failure, you know, and that's for doing 140 characters. That's pretty good money for a 140-character app. Or people see what's going on, you know, that all these people are having to drive Uber cars and all these other people are having to rent their apartments through Airbnb. You know, people are becoming aware of the fact that the growth of all of these companies is not leading to any sort of participation or distribution of the assets to others. So we're being forced, really one by one, we're being forced to make decisions in new ways. And those new ways tend to favor a more stable, resilient, steady state economy. I mean, and that's the income disparity, which has been, you know, growing over time, ends up really exacerbated by these accelerated digital business models. You know, you look at the effect of something like Airbnb or Uber or Amazon Mechanical Turks, you know, gig employment on people. And it really makes these digital companies look like almost like software that's been designed purely to extract currency and value from people and turn it into share price for companies. So you just see that it's not just a competitive landscape, but an extractive landscape.
I have to ask you, I mean, I guess everyone is going to ask you this question, but throwing rocks at the Google bus. Are you referring to the protests that took place out in the Bay Area?
Yeah.
Related specifically to consumers being resentful of the gig that Google employees had with their own transportation shuttle system?
Yeah. I mean, it's looking at the way originally the protests in San Francisco were about how sort of foreign Google employees and the bus that they were using were changing real estate values in San Francisco. Even around the bus stops, the rents hadn't just doubled like everywhere else. Around the bus stops, they were 30% higher than they were in the other parts of San Francisco. And local businesses were going out of business because they couldn't pay their rents. So Google was changing the fabric of the community and not in ways that the residents could even participate in. So it really became, well, it was a real problem, but it was also a very symbolic problem. It was one that we could all relate to as we look at a company like Google, which we thought was on our team, you know, that this was going to be the way that the economy got restored and we were all going to be able to create value and have new kinds of jobs. And the digital economy didn't work out the way we thought it would, that these companies are getting bigger while the rest of us are getting poorer. You know, and yeah, a couple of weeks after the original protest, some protesters in Oakland actually threw rocks at the bus. And I remember a lot of tweets coming through saying, yay, you know, people were excited about it and wanted to know why I couldn't cheer along with what was happening, because everybody was mad at Google for being, you know, they were snooping on us with the NSA. It was a particularly dark time for Google. And I said, I couldn't applaud this because I know people on those buses. You know, they're just kids trying to get a programming job and stay employed for 3 years before they burn out and make enough money. And I started to think, who is there to blame? And you can't even really blame the CEO of Google, because he has to answer to the shareholders. So you can blame the shareholders, but that's the likes of us with our 401k plans. We've got a S&P 500 fund in there that owns Google, and we're going to sell it if it's not making money. So the only way to really correct this problem is to start looking at it more systemically. How do you actually make a business that is going to create jobs for people around you? You know, even if Walmart and Uber started to look at their businesses from the perspective of economic development, I'm going to move into a town just like I move into a developing nation. How am I going to create enough economic development so that I have customers, so that I have employees, so that I can stay alive another 5 or 10 years?
So I can help people, they'll like me, and they won't throw rocks at my butts, and I can stick around.
Exactly. And that's not necessarily utopia, but it's just kind of, well, just all getting along.
Douglas Rushkoff is author of Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. Speaking of unsustainable growth, or questionably sustainable growth, Starbucks, in its contemporary American style of doing the coffee thing, has made its mark all around the world, but has feared to tread into Italy until now. Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz says that by 2017, there should be a Starbucks store operating somewhere in the land liberated by Garibaldi. Can you imagine the outpouring of love that will be generated from coffee-loving Italians? Here's one. Under the hashtag Starbucks Italia could destroy the country. Some serious worry, says another Wired Italian reader. It's a sign of the apocalypse on par with lousy American pizza. We welcome all those joining the Takeaway from Italy, anywhere in the world, perhaps for the first time in Northern Colorado. We're delighted to be a part of your new lineup on KUNC 91.5 FM. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is the Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
Public Radio International.